In this Climate Gen episode, I'm speaking with three young people from the Cayman Islands about the existential climate threat they face. They're taking their case to the British government to ask for assistance in what could eventually lead to an evacuation plan. The Cayman Islands are a British overseas territory lying to the south of Cuba and the northeast of Honduras. Currently, an estimated 85% of the world's hedge funds are located in these islands. The irony is that a significant percentage of the funds flowing through the Cayman Isles will be invested in or derived from fossil fuels, the very cause of the regional climate destabilisation that is getting much worse. Elia, Rakim and Connor from Sustainable Cayman all have a case to make to the British people that could end up being part of the transformational change we need immediately. The London meeting at the House of Commons with MPs is in collaboration with One Planet in the UK and is the start of a dialogue that aims to encourage the UK to act responsibly in the face of existential threats to these islands. Thank you to all subscribers for support. This is a special episode timed for the event in London, and more episodes will be forthcoming. Please like and share and continue to subscribe and support this work. You can also order my book Cop Out from Amazon or any other bookstore, which highlights the structural failures that are driving the worsening worldwide climate emergency. Thank you. Rakim, Ailey and Connor, it's very, very nice to meet you all. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me. You're preparing to present to the British government a case for what you're facing in the Cayman Islands. Can you try and give us a sort of flavour of what you've already experienced? I mean, I know you've had a devastating storm very recently. Can you explain your experience of what that's like when these impacts strike?
I'm presently on Grand Cayman, which is the largest island of the three. And this kind of storm is called Nor'wester. It's typically something that happens every single year. It's a regularly occurring natural phenomenon that happens, I guess, when the cold fronts meet with the warmer air, and it creates these kind of severe weather events where the seas kind of get extremely rough, rougher than normal. What we saw in the last couple of weeks was serious property damage. People who were not used to essentially seeing these large waves coming crashing in into the coast, going out to potentially look and see. And, you know, I think there was a video of a person that almost got swept away when that happened. So hearing that these things are going to get worse, obviously with the climate crisis happening and these impacts coming more frequently and more severely, just seeing that the response, you know, and the people are forgetting that in the past couple of years, what happened to the properties and the new inhabitants of the island that's come from abroad to come live in the Cayman Islands weren't used to this and never really heard of this. You know, it's kind of like foreshadowing what's to come, you know, if we don't actually go back to our basics and our roots and actually start thinking about, you know, the future in regards to like events like this that happen every year and the ones that are projected to happen. You know,
and what's the bounce back? How long does it take you to sort of come back from one of these sort of extreme events?
Right now, if after 2 weeks, you know, I've seen some pretty heartwarming things where the community comes to help some of these businesses that have been there for like several years, probably decades even, like a lot of the dive bars and those things, people from the community who actually come and help rebuild some of these places that have been damaged. And that's how it used to be, you know, in the past. So you'd say probably like a couple months to get back, you know, to operating standard, and then probably a little months after to continue the trajectory where they were going on before. For the newer installations, like new properties that have been built, I'm not sure how long it would take to get these back, because I know a couple homes that were like right up on the coast, they've been completely battered. Like some people probably would have to like leave and vacate that area. So I'm not entirely sure like.
And you talked about the sea getting rougher. I'm assuming you get a tidal surge in these situations.
You do. Yeah. The coastal properties, many of the people who have moved in to see the beach and to live alongside the other side of it is, you know, the beach has the opportunity to come and see you inside of these houses. So, yeah, that's one of the sides that you don't really think about. In that sense, you see a lot of frustration with the, I guess, lack of information sharing in that perspective. They come here to see these things, but you weren't really thinking about, oh, maybe we should have our important things higher up, because this is a thing that might happen.
Speaking to scientists, they're saying, we're getting a buildup of much more moisture in the atmosphere. We've got this ongoing problem of sea level rise. And that's presumably a loaded gun to you guys because you are in that sort of trajectory. What does it? There's two parts to this question. So the first one is, how aware are people on the island? Obviously, you've been hit, so people are aware these things are happening, but how much is the awareness in the context of the wider climate change problem? And the second one is about the viability of everything going forward.
I can answer the first part. So I can't, that's sort of my entire focus as a journalist. I kind of look to understand what people take from these situations and how they apply it to their daily lives. From what I've seen, there's an understanding of, the weather is getting worse and there are things that have an impact on the weather and that's impacting my livelihood. But in terms of the larger scope and the bigger picture, I don't know that it's maybe it's understood, but it's not necessarily taken seriously, or it's not seen as something that we have anything to do with. Because we're so small, a lot of people back home think that I'm in London, so back home in Cayman, a lot of people think that we don't produce enough to have a significant impact on the environment, which isn't true. We consume a lot and we produce a lot of emissions, and people don't necessarily see the correlation between our output and our lack of sustainability connecting to the way that the weather is developing and the way that their homes are being destroyed in the process.
And tell me the case you're going to make in the House of Commons, what it is you want people to actually acknowledge from the British side.
Our main point of going to the House of Commons is really just drawing attention to the fact that we don't have enough of a preventative or proactive plan in terms of the way that we respond to the weather. We are sort of just reacting to it whenever it happens to us and not establishing a good connection between ourselves and the UK so that if need be, we have access to aid and access to people being able to leave and not feel like they're continuously threatened. So at the House of Commons, Danielle and I we'll be talking to representatives and letting them know that this is something that we need now. Because if we continue to put it off, it's going to put countless people's lives at risk and it's going to put the Cayman at an economic and social disadvantage.
So you need it now,
Yes.
but presumably this is at the opening of a dialogue. What's your level of expectation? Do you think you're going to get a good hearing out of this?
I think that we will get a decent level of hearing. I don't have my hopes set too high, but the fact that we're having this meeting at all is heartening to me. I think we'll pull on some heartstrings and get some people who are very senior to look at what we're talking about and to understand. That may take longer than we want, but it really is part of the process. And I think that's we're kind of here for the long game.
Were all of you at COP28?
I went to 27.
You went to 27. What's been your mission at the COPs?
So I was at COP28 as well. And yeah, my whole expectation and what I went there for was to kind of give a voice to these small island nations or large ocean nations, as we like to refer to them now. Because none of the problems we are facing are small, like this Northwest that just came through wreaked havoc on our coastal communities. And something that people weren't really talking about afterwards was our natural barriers to these storms, like mangrove, seagrass, and coral reefs. We have some of the largest percentage of coral cover in the Caribbean, but that percentage doesn't really matter if it's not healthy. I went free diving the other day in Grand Cayman, and there are new caves. There are coral smashed to bits just because of this wave action. And I feel like I'm the only one that knows about it. So I feel like it's kind of like my duty to go off and to explain this to as many people as I possibly can, because I feel like people really only care about and listen to stuff they can understand, which is why I'm so into education, because through that you can teach people the problems we are facing today and how they can help and to keep them informed. So that was a big part of my push at COP28.
if you look at it through the sort of coral lens, I've been talking to people, you know, down around the Great Barrier Reef, which is in a sort of crisis point. I spoke to someone last week in Honduras talking about their coral reefs. It seems like it's almost like our overall climate thermometer at the moment, telling us about the health of the oceans and basically this sort of sensitivity to the damage we're collectively doing, especially in developed nations where the emissions are so high. So there is a responsibility for the British government and other governments to respond right across the board. Can I ask about how much is the youth voice getting heard? How much do you speak to each other? What's the level of awareness? Can you give me a sort of insight there?
Well, in my experience, like, the youth's voice is getting louder and louder. Every single year, every single month, every single day, you know, whether or not that translate into, you know, actual action by government or, you know, in policy, you know, that's a little bit harder, but that's across the board. That's globally, you know, youth and engagement and youth capacity building is sort of like a new buzzword that popped up at COP28 and like even the last COP. But we are starting to see, you know, more and more, I guess, active engagement from our government, from the decision makers, and they are taking us on board in terms of like building us up to actually make sustainability mean something. Because if sustainability means saving something for future generations, after you're gone, who's gonna be the one, you know, taking that forward is the youth. So I think they're starting to actually think about that now. With regards to communication within our own like bubble, you know, we speak regularly, like even in light of this Northwestern that passed, everybody was sending videos of the event to every single person. Like there's some people up on top of their roofs, like, look at the sea from this angle, look at this, look at what happened in my community, kind of thing. And like the communication and knowledge transfer, and like everybody's kind of like on the pulse in terms of like the direction that we want to bring our islands in regards to like sustainability and climate change and climate crisis and sea level rise and all of these things. So it's very hopeful when you see all of the different faces. It's back ago, it'd probably be like one or two or three faces you see everywhere, but now it's becoming more diverse. You're seeing a new person pop up from the schools now and different organizations that are like bringing people and posting them saying, this is our person who's like kind of our sustainability or climate change actor, advocate and ambassador. You know, we want to push this person and make their voices be heard in terms of, you know, getting their, I guess, not only opinions, but perspectives and knowledge disseminated across not just the youth, but the entire community.
You talk about going up on the roof and filming these sort of, I mean, there must be a rising level of fear. Connor just mentioned going swimming down and looking at the corals. Then you've got these storms, the actual being there during or you know, witnessing the surrounding period. Is there a rising fear, do you think, that you're all kind of responding to as well, that's bringing you together, saying, you know, we need to make some noise now, it's all getting a bit out of hand?
It's partly those in the know who are like actively aware of what's happening, because some of these things aren't being spoken about. If you don't know, you simply can't be worried. I wasn't really privy to the conversation of, you know, forced migration. That wasn't even in the front of my head. I was thinking of more like coral restoration, mangrove restoration, you know. But like there's certain things that you can't really build yourself out of or like try to keep up with. Like sea level rise is something that's going to outrun most of us. And us being a low-lying country, we don't really have any other choice when it push comes to shove. And the worst case scenario happens based on the projections that have been published, you know. With a couple decades down the line, this amount of sea level rise will equate to all of these things. So in that sense, people who are aware of that do feel that kind of push, that fire behind them trying to get this ball rolling. Because right now, if the conversation isn't even being had, there's no preparation and then there's no plan. And then when it's a reactive kind of situation, how many people are going to get left behind because you don't have enough time to account for them? So when you think of it from that perspective and the people who are aware of that, you can actually feel that kind of tension in kind of everything that they do with regards to getting this message out.
During COP28, a lot of the people from the Caribbean like to hang out and like talk to each other because we're all from the same region. And I had the pleasure of speaking to this woman from Dominica, and she was telling us this story that really plays into what these storms can do on someone's mental health, because Dominica had a very strong hurricane a few years back. And she was telling me stories of how ever since, every time it would rain, kids would be asking, are we having another hurricane? Are we having another hurricane? I might have to go back to the roof. Is it going to flood? So not only do we have to worry about how close we're building to the ocean, for example, but we also need to worry about how we're going to increase mental health during these times of crisis.
Gosh. Yeah, no, I totally understand, yeah. Because, yeah, the next question I was going to ask is about how much of this is about sort of infrastructure resilience and how much is it about sort of your natural infrastructure? You've mentioned the mangroves, you've mentioned corals and things like this.
Of course, there's some things, like Rakim said, you can build your way out of. Some of these impacts we can work around and we can try to bolster ourselves against. But in terms of the natural defenses that we've already lost, it sort of forces us into a position of looking at more drastic measures. So it sort of needs to be a simultaneous adaptation where we are bolstering the island and doing things to make sure that we're not making the problem worse, but then also being realistic and seeing that countries like Dominica are not that different from us. We have a lot of the same structures and we face a lot of the same problems. So it's not unlikely that we will be in the same position in a few years. So in that vein, it needs to be a collaborative effort in terms of balancing, okay, how do we prepare for the future, but how do we also preserve the present?
I hear so much from different industries and areas, all kinds of sort of facets, where the key accelerator to resilience seems to be collaboration. It seems to be this sort of idea of sharing the progress you're making, how you do it, what you do. And
yeah,
it's good to hear that that's permeating through the region. People who live on these islands, the last thing they actually want to do is leave. It is their home. And that's the point. So even as some kind of evacuation plan is very much a last resort, you know. But if you cast your mind forward, your imagination in some respects based on what you know, what would be your sort of positive best case and your sort of, I don't want to say worst case, but sort of it's on your radar, but you really want to try and fight it off? Can you sort of give us a picture of what you want to see versus what would be what you would not like so much to see?
Like Aaliyah was saying earlier, locally we do produce a lot of carbon emissions, but when you look at it from an entire worldview, we obviously don't expel as much as, say, the US does. So what we can do locally will make a large difference locally, but it's what countries around the world do that will also impact us. So what we can do locally is not build so close to the ocean and implement buffer zones where you allow mangroves and other vegetation to grow between your house and the beach, so that we don't cause further sea level rise and beach erosion, because it's ultimately a legacy we want to leave behind. If we're going to have to be evacuated, we're going to want to say that we did everything we can to try to prevent this through implementing buffer zones, through protecting our central mangrove wetland. We don't want to say we continue to build luxury condos and hotels right on the beach, which only quickens the process.
Just piggybacking off of what Connor said, that would be our ideal situation. And really the worst case scenario is probably the evacuation plan. When I first heard of it, when we first started talking about that being a potential, I just felt an immediate like grip on my chest. There was just an immediate settle of anxiety and stress. And that is, it's not something that you want to talk about, but you know, you plan to fail, fail to plan. And I think that if we don't, you know, take considerate action now, then it's going to become more of a reality than a scenario. It's most definitely our worst option at the moment, but it's, you know, you have to be realistic and you have to plan.
There was this interesting intersection that came up during this process of, you know, writing this report that I didn't really think of before. You know, initially we'd look at our size of as an island physically, you know, looking at our emissions, we're tiny, we can't really be emitting much. But then when you look at our situation in terms of being like a financial center, and I think the last stat I remember, everybody knows 85% of the world's money, like the hedge funds, goes through the Cayman Islands kind of thing. How much of that is investments in fossil fuel? I wouldn't be surprised to see if it's quite a chunk. So in that sense, we're indirectly having a huge impact by allowing this kind of investment to go happen within our island. So when you look at it in that kind of perspective, we are probably one of the biggest producers because we facilitate it. So in my best case scenario, any kind of situation where, and I know this sounds scary because like that's one of our, I guess it's like what, our second largest bringer of like our GDP kind of thing, but like have some sort of steer these investments in a direction that turns away from fossil fuels. I don't want to word any more harsh than that because, you know, I fear like, you know, everybody fears people just pulling out and running away because those are probably the most lucrative investments that they have. But in a sense, leveraging our sort of status as a financial center to ensure that these investments are green and actually yeah. promoting the future that we want to see globally, worldwide, is something that I'd see in like a best case scenario as we like think not only future, but right now, because that's something that could start right now, you know? Yeah.
I love that concept. I am a big believer in our entire economic, political, social system needs a major overhaul. I think, personally, at least, I've seen that the systems we have right now, they don't work, at least not for the benefit of the common person. And I think shifting our economy away from such a heavy focus on tourism activities that destroy the environment and, you know, financial activities that do the same, I think that really gives us an opportunity to not only set the tone for what is expected in the Caribbean and how Caribbean countries can function and prosper without being a detriment. I think it'll also give the Caymanian society something to say that they're proud of. I think a lot of us feel a bit detached from this sort of legacy that we have for tourism. Maybe if you spoke to our grandparents and parents, they would think otherwise because prior to the technological boom that we've experienced, they were more hands-on with the tourism industry. And now it's not the same. So we need to sort of shift away from this secondary idea of tourism and how much money it brings in and kind of look towards something that is a little bit more people focused and more sustainable.
Thank you very much for speaking to me. I hope you fall on good ears in Westminster and this all you know really starts a really good dialogue. It's really deserves some wider attention, and I think the attention of British people, I think there should be some interest in being part of the story. Thank you.
No, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Breen.